Welcome to Teacher Quit Talk. I'm Miss Redacted.
And I'm Mrs. Frazzled. Every week we explore the teacher exodus to find out what, if anything, could get these educators back in the classroom.
We've all had our moments where we thought, what the hell am I doing here? From burnout to bureaucracy to soul-sucking stressors and creative dead ends.
From recognizing when it was time to go to navigating feelings of guilt and regret afterwards, we're here to cut out the gaslighting and get real about what it means to leave teaching.
We've got insights from former teachers from all over the country who have seen it all. So get ready to be disturbed. Join us on Teacher Quit Talk to laugh through the pain of the U.S. education system. We'll see you there.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Дамы и господа, добро пожаловать в Prevail. Это второй сезон нашей борьбы с криминальными сволочами. Ваш ведущий Грегор О'Лиар.
I'm Greg O'Lear. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. I hope everyone had a wonderful holiday weekend. Whatever holiday that you happen to celebrate, I hope that you enjoyed it. Here in New York, the weather suddenly got really nice, and that was a treat. Flowers on my tree in my backyard, lovely light pink flowers in full bloom, just beautiful. Belying, I think, the topic of today's show, when we bring on the journalist David DeYoung, who wrote a book that's out now called Nazi Billionaires: The Dark History of Germany's Wealthiest Dynasties. Before we get into that, I want to talk about sports for a minute because it ties into what this episode is about. There is a player in the NFL, the National Football League, named Deshaun Watson. Maybe you've heard of him, probably you have not. He is a quarterback. Quarterback is the most difficult position and the most important position in any sport to play. There are at any given time a dozen people who can play quarterback at a great to elite level. It is a skill set that is very, very highly valued because very few people can do what it takes to play quarterback. Tom Brady is going to be 45 years old. He's still playing because he is one of the few people who can do the damn job, right? Deshaun Watson is one of those guys. He's a guy he's tough. Has a good arm. He's kind of a winning player. He's 26 years old, so he's entering his prime. He's good. Last season, he played for the Houston Texans, which is the team that drafted him, and he did not play last year at all. The Texans chose to not play him at all. And the reason why they chose not to play this guy, who is one of few people on earth who can play quarterback at an elite level, is because Deshaun Watson was in a little bit of a legal problem. He was being sued by 22 women, massage therapists, for sexual misconduct, let's just call it, during massages that he got while quarterback of the Texans. 22 women in a civil suit. There was also a criminal investigation. The DA decided ultimately not to press criminal charges against him. That happened fairly recently, about a month ago, it was announced. Once that happened, teams that needed an elite quarterback pounced. The Cleveland Browns already had a quarterback, this guy Baker Mayfield, who's in some of these progressive commercials that you see on the TV. They didn't care. They wanted a better quarterback. They felt that if they had a better quarterback, that'll push them over the hump, get them a championship. And Deshaun Watson is a great quarterback. He is. No question. They're bringing in a guy. They traded for this guy. Whatever they traded. 3 number 1 picks, 4, some ridiculous thing. To get this guy. Then they handed him a guaranteed contract, which in professional football, the contracts are rarely guaranteed. You know, you might say, oh, this guy signed a $100 million contract, but he winds up getting, you know, $10 million. I don't know why the NFL does it that way, but that's how they roll, right? But this guy's contract, guaranteed, 5 years, $230 million. Guaranteed. Not only that, they structured the contract so that if he gets suspended this year for his misconduct, the big money doesn't come till after this year. So he's really only going to lose, you know, scare quotes, only $1 million here, $1 million there of this guaranteed quarter bill, almost, okay, that he's going to earn playing quarterback. Now, the criminal charges are, they're not going to happen. 22 women are suing him for sexual misconduct. 22 women, under oath, swore, joined the lawsuit, stating that he did, I'm not going to get into what he did. You can Google it if you want, but it's not good. It's gross stuff that he did, allegedly. Now, if you're writing a story for the newspaper, they say they need 3 sources before they'll go live with the story, before they're comfortable with it, to go live with something and print something. 3 different sources. 22 people under oath is like, it's pretty ironclad. There's just, it seems insane that there is not fire where there's smoke here, okay? And of course, all anyone can talk about in Cleveland is this pall hanging over the sky. But it didn't matter. Why didn't it matter? Because Deshaun Watson can play quarterback. And there's, again, there's a dozen people on earth that can do it at any given time. $230 million guaranteed. That's $10 million for every woman in the lawsuit, plus an extra $10 million just because, to put it in perspective, okay? I bring this up because it sort of goes along with David's book, the Nazi Billionaire's book, not to suggest that Deshaun Watson is a Nazi, but I don't know that character-wise, he's a good guy. It seems like, I don't know, I'm going to believe the 22 women personally and say that he's kind of not a good guy, not somebody I want to root for, not somebody who deserves to be rewarded with this enormous contract at all, especially when you have a guy like Kaepernick, Colin Kaepernick, who can still play quarterback at least a backup level, and nobody will sign him at all. And what did he do? He knelt during the game. He's too political. Come on. This guy, 22 women. But it ties into the book here, because what David found in his research in this book about these billionaire families in Germany and their families. Honestly, I don't know the last names of the families as much as somebody living in Germany would know them, but they are associated with, you know, big companies, BMW and Porsche and stuff like that. And, you know, you've heard of the companies, if not the people involved. And what happened at the end of the Second World War with some of these Nazis, especially the scientists, the engineers, there's only so many people on the planet that could do what they could do. And everybody knew it. So the United States government, in Operation Paperclip, basically said, you know what? I know these guys are Nazis, but if they don't come to the United States, the Soviets will get them, and that would be worse. So let's take these engineers here. We'll refurbish them. We'll pretend that they're not Nazis, and that'll be that. And, you know, in Germany generally has done a really good job with reconciling with its Nazi past, with the Third Reich, and the government has done a lot of strides in a way that the U.S. government has not with regards to the slavery or the genocide of the indigenous people, right? We just don't bother. We just turn the page, got to move on. That's our attitude. In Germany, it's not like that. In Germany, they really made a concerted effort to learn and to reconcile the horror that the government did, right? But still, people slip through the cracks. These people with money, people with talent or perceived talent, or, you know, whether that's political talent or the ability to get people together or the ability to do engineering or whatever it is, certain people get away with things. And their sins are just ignored because of the talent. And we see this also. I mean, you see it at the Oscars, right? there was the big to-do about, okay, Will Smith and the slap, we know about that. And then they talk about, okay, well, what about Roman Polanski? What about Woody Allen? What about these guys that did really, really bad things? How do we reconcile that? And, you know, I don't know what the answer is. And, you know, David doesn't really know the answer either. But in the book, he examines the families, the origins of the families, like what the patriarchs of these families and the matriarchs in some cases did during the war, you know, which is basically German companies use slave labor to get rich. And how did they reconcile it after? And how are those companies reconciling it now? Have they come clean? No, he says in the book. So that's kind of the theme of the show today. It's a Deshaun Watson themed show, because here's a guy who really should not play in the NFL because of this, or there should be some kind of punishment or penalty that he has to face, which he probably, it's going to be a 4-game suspension. 22 women, 4 games. Probably that's the likelihood is what's going to happen. And then he's going to make his $230 million guaranteed. Even if he sucks, even if he gets hurt, no matter what happens, they're on the hook, the Cleveland Browns, for $230 million to this guy who seems pretty clearly to be a serial sexual abuser and assailant. But because he can play quarterback, it's okay. It's kind of the same thing with these Nazi billionaires. That's the link that I made. Okay, yeah, they did this, this, and this, but they can also do this, this, and this, so maybe we'll just turn a blind eye. And I'm not saying necessarily that we need to cancel every single person that ever did anything bad. I think there is, there has to be a way for people to rehabilitate themselves and to have penance for their sins, whether it's going to jail and doing your time, you know, you paid your debt to society, whatever. Deshaun Watson, in the first press conference, basically denied that there was anything to the allegations at all, which is, come on, dude. And they asked him if he would have done anything differently, and he said no. So not only is he not being thoughtful about it, being apologetic, he's denying that it even happened, which seems ridiculous to me. And from a PR standpoint, it's terrible. Basically, the guy that doesn't think that the rules apply to him. And I know that I'm sick of guys like that. I'm sure everybody listening to this show is just sick of guys like that. When are the rules going to apply to these guys? How many times can an Elon Musk manipulate the market on Twitter before he gets caught, before something happens? Martha Stewart, if you look at what she did for insider trading, and then you look at what Elon Musk is up to, like, I'm not a lawyer, I don't understand securities, but it's all about manipulating the market. You're not allowed to do that. It's against the rules to do some of this stuff that they're doing. I don't understand. Like, you watch it, you're like, what is going on here? Eric Prince, we know that guy's dirty. Greg Smith, who worked with him for years, and then, you know, once it got to a place where he saw it was illegal, he went to the authorities. He went to the FBI. We're still waiting for this guy to get busted. Why? I don't know. Is it money? Connections? Is it because they can do something that very few people in the world can do? And I think that probably was Epstein's bag also, you know? Evil guy, horrible man. Whatever it was that that guy was doing for whoever it was he was working for was clearly something that not many other people either could or were willing to do. And that's why he stuck around for so long. And that's why people turned turned a blind eye to all the horrors that he was doing. So I don't know. I just feel like in our society right now, it's just at the point where it seems like certain people are just going to get away with things. And I really hope that by the time that I'm recording this on April 14th, and I'm hoping that by the time this airs, I'll already regret saying it. But I just feel like it's just, you know, if you're a Deshaun Watson, meaning you're somebody who has the elite skill or you're being protected or whatever it is, different rules apply to you. And that's just how it goes. And I don't think we should accept that as a society. I don't think we should accept it as a country and as a nation. You know, we have to be a nation of laws. And if we're not, we're no better than Putin's Russia. And, you know, it's all a joke. And I don't like it to be all a joke. I only like my fake ads to be a joke. So All right. I'm almost 15 minutes into this. That's too long. Too much talking from me. So I'm going to step away now. The book is called Nazi Billionaires, The Dark History of Germany's Wealthiest Dynasties. We'll be right back with David DeYoung.
General Shoigu made plans for Ukraine on orders from Vladimir Putin. He knew it wouldn't work because it's fucking insane. His soldiers are killing and looting. Yeah, he screwed up so bad he had a heart attack. You ought to know by now. Polonium T and the Novichok work even when there are no windows. And you know that it's long past time. Of that there can be no doubt. The only way you will survive is take Putin out. Go take Putin out. Ooh, yeah.
David DeYoung, welcome to the Prevail podcast.
Thank you very much for having me, Greg.
So you've written this book, which is, when is the release date on your book?
April 19th.
April 19th is soon. We're recording this on April 9th. So by the time people are listening to this, it will be out, I think. The book is called Nazi Billionaires, The Dark History of Germany's Wealthiest Dynasties. And we're going to talk a lot about the book during this interview. Before we go there, tell everybody a little bit about your background. Now, you're based in Amsterdam, or you were, and you wrote for Bloomberg. So tell us a little bit about your background.
So actually, so I was born and raised in Amsterdam, and then I moved to New York to study for my master's in history, actually. And I stuck around New York, and I got a job at Bloomberg News at the time in 2011, which was on a team that investigated hidden wealth and billionaire fortunes. And I was actually hired as one of the America correspondents at the time, or one of the America reporters at the time. But I was soon asked, because I'm Dutch, if I could cover the Germanic speaking countries. You know, of course, in America, everybody automatically assumes if you're Dutch, then you must speak German. But which
do
at the
you?
Time
you
wasn't,
do?
Wasn't,
do you speak German?
At the time, it was, yeah, well, now I do. Now I do. At the time, it was, you know, it was, my German was weak, but it's improved incredibly over the past decade. So it was great. You know, I mean, I got to cover that subject. And, you know, what I found were these stories that mixed kind of history and finance and business. And what struck me always during my reporting was, so in Germany, you have this thing whenever there's a public, you know, whenever a media story breaks about the Nazi history of family A or company B, they immediately say in response, we're going to commission this academic study we're going to reckon with it. We're going to have it all investigated. And then once the study comes out 3-4 years later, you know, they give one mea culpa interview. The studies are only published in academic German. So the reckoning is, who exactly is the reckoning with, right? Because most of the victims were in German. And then they go on to the outside, they go on to do like pretend like nothing's happened. You know, you have today, you have BMW and Porsche, for instance, maintaining global foundations in the name of their patriarchs who either committed or were responsible for crimes during the Third Reich or were members of genocide organizations like the SS or donors to it or members of the Nazi Party. And they don't mention any of that history online. So an unsuspecting grantee would never know that he's receiving money from a foundation in the name of a Nazi war criminal.
Yeah, which is problematic. I think I'm thinking about how it would apply in the United States. Like, you know, we have our own in the U.S., our own horrible history, too, that has to be reckoned with.
Definitely.
And it isn't.
I have an analogy, actually. You know, if the Ford Foundation, right? I mean, Henry Ford was a virulent anti-Semite, loved Hitler. The Ford Foundation has never been named after Henry Ford, or it was named after Henry Ford up until 1946, and then it was renamed Ford Foundation, you know, and it's, of course, it's no longer controlled by the Ford family. Already for many decades, it hasn't been, but you don't have money being given in the name of Henry Ford. I think that's the closest analogy I would give in the US.
What is it with these car manufacturers wanting to be Nazis?
That is a good question.
Is there something in the, I was thinking about this before, you know, thinking of questions to ask. It just seems weird that between Porsche and I don't know. Maybe it's just coincidental.
Well, I mean, the Quant family, that has a near majority control of BMW today. They did not own BMW
at the time.
Okay. During the Third Reich, they owned a massive battery company, and they owned a massive arms manufacturing company, and they had a stake in Daimler Benz already at the time, very small, 4%, and a stake in a big oil and gas, or what then a potash and gas company, which is also still very well known today in Germany, it's a listed company. But out of the day, they weren't yet into car manufacturing. They all made a pivot in the 1950s when mass motorization came about. And there's another example I give in the book of Friedrich Flick, who ended up being convicted at the Nuremberg trials. He oversaw the largest steel, coal, and weapons, privately held steel, coal, and weapons conglomerate during the Third Reich, and was convicted at Nuremberg, was released from prison, his sentence was commuted by the American government, and then was released from prison, and then within a decade came back on top as Germany's wealthiest man by becoming the controlling shareholder of Daimler Benz. Especially with the Quants and the Flicks, you see in the 1950s, they start collaborating together in BMW and Daimler Benz, and they become together with Deutsche Bank. They become this triumvirate, which you know, controls Daimler Benz, and then the Quants ended up becoming the BMW Quants ended up becoming the controlling shareholders of BMW.
Interesting. Now, you said when you started off at the desk at Bloomberg that they put you into this group that was looking into these big fortunes. Were you interested in that before? Is that what you studied in school?
Yeah, I was. No, I mean, I studied political science and international relations and history in my bachelor's and master's. Mm-hmm. Particularly, my master's was a research master's in history. I was always quite good with numbers. I was comfortable with numbers. My father is an emeritus professor of econometrics, so it didn't come, you know, becoming a financial journalist, giving my investigative skills at one hand, and at the other hand, you know, being comfortable with numbers and figures was not far-fetched. And I also found it the kind of the hidden wealth, the people who control swaths of the global economy. Yeah. And kind of the at the time, you know, when I joined Bloomberg's team, it was literally late November 2011, and it was right at the tail end of Occupy Wall Street. It was literally I started the job the week after, you know, Occupy Wall Street was forcibly removed from Zuccotti Park. Okay. I remember when I was having these conversations with Bloomberg, I would also go down to Zuccotti Park and see what was going on there in September 2011 when it all started. And it, of course, you know, enveloped the globe, and this model of the 1% versus the 99%, you know, it's only grown. It's only become a much stronger cause in the past decade. Inequality has grown significantly, especially during the pandemic.
Yeah.
Also, the rise of Bernie Sanders has also, you know, was very much, took that message. Well, has always had the same message, basically. Yeah.
No matter what's going on in the world, his message never changes.
Exactly, right. He's always on message. But it is interesting to see the development from 2011 to now to 2022.
Sure.
And how it's become much, much more prominent and much more bigger problem, too, for society.
Yeah. Now, you start off in the book, you talk a little bit about your own family history. So I thought that was pretty interesting. Would you mind sharing that with the listeners and telling that story?
So my maternal grandparents, my maternal grandfather, who was, he tried to flee. He was a very avid sailor, and he was 25 at the time. At the time of the war, he was from 1917. He was 23 when the war started, when Germany invaded the Netherlands. And at 25, he and his best friend tried to sail to England to join the Royal Air Force. And the first time it failed. And the second time it failed again, and they were blown back to shore, and they were apprehended. They were arrested by German soldiers, and they were sentenced as political prisoners, and they were sent off to Germany as for to do forced labor. My grandfather was 6'7", and he came out weighing 90 pounds.
Oh my gosh.
So he, you know, was emaciated, and he was forced to work in a steel factory in the Ruhr area, which was the most industrialized area in a town called Bochum, and or a city called Bochum. And he luckily survived, and went to a sanatorium in Switzerland, and asked my grandmother, who was his next door neighbor from back home, to marry him. And soon after that, my mother was born, the eldest of four siblings. And then my father's parents were Jewish, and my grandmother was Swiss. And my grandfather, he hid in Amsterdam for 3.5 years. He had grown up on, he had a German mother even, and he had grown up on the Dutch-German border. And his stocking factories, where his textile factories were confiscated by the Germans. And he fled to Amsterdam, where he hid for 3.5 years. Whereas my grandmother and my aunt, who was 3 at the time, and a companion of them, fled to Switzerland, where my grandmother was from, and were apprehended at the French-Swiss border by the Gestapo. And the Gestapo officer took pity on my grandmother and my aunt and let them go, which was, you know, a total miracle, because the Gestapo were the most hardened of Jew hunters of all the Nazis, together with the SS. But her companion was deported to Sobibor and was murdered in an extermination. And my grandmother and aunt made it over the border, aided by a shepherd, and made it into Switzerland. And of course, you know, Switzerland was neutral, so they stayed the rest of the war in Zurich, where she was from, and survived.
Wow.
And they were all reunited. So it's always, I always think, you know, it's a miracle that my parents are here. It's a miracle that I'm here. It's a miracle that all my four grandparents made it through the war. But that also made me a bit reluctant at the time. I was asked, I didn't tell my bosses at the time, to cover the German speaking countries, because, you know, I'm of the last generation. You know, I was born in the late 80s. I'm of the last generation who grew up with this kind of, well, I call it playful antagonism in the book, you know, and it mainly expresses itself on the soccer field, you know, where we were kind of hesitant towards the Germans. But I actually came, you know, my partner is German. I lived the past 4.5 years. I lived in Berlin. Most of my friends are German. I love Germany. And but actually, all of that came about because I was asked to cover the Germanics and to delve into the subject, right? So
there's some sort of karma there, apparently. There's some sort of thing that you have to, mission that you have to do. So I want to talk about, thank you for sharing that. I know that's it's quite a story. Anytime I hear these stories, you think, my God, it's miraculous that anybody survived. And I think it's important.
It is.
To tell the stories now, because they're not it's not that long ago that this happened.
It is not that long ago. It is not that long ago. And there's still, you know, there's still so many people. There is still a you know, whether it's in Eastern Europe or in Israel or in the US or in other parts of Europe or in the UK or South America, there's so many people still around today who have experienced all of that.
Yeah,
but there will also come a point soon when those people will not be around, and it's very important that these stories are told again and again and again. And I'm sure that for the decades to come, so many more stories will be unearthed and will be told.
Yeah, it's important. I feel like the rise of fascism globally now, this right-wing movement, is because so many of the prime, the primary sources are very old or dead. I feel like the fact that nobody's lived through that, at least in the West, informs everybody's and the right's ability to kind of gloss over the really awful stuff that happened.
Well, that's actually, it's the rewriting of history, or it's a whitewashing of history, which is the most problematic part.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also the reason why I wrote this book. You know, the driving argument in my book is arguing in favor of historical transparency.
Yeah,
and the reason why I wrote the book is because I don't think people should be conducting philanthropy in the names of Nazi war criminals without being fully transparent about who these people were online, and after a so-called reckoning. I think that's perverse.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. All right. I want to talk a little bit about Germany, just big picture, just for people who might not be familiar. At the end of World War One, which Germany kind of wound up getting sucked into and being the main bad guy or the main antagonist, almost crazily so. That was the end of the Hohenzollerns. That was the end of that government.
Abdication, yeah.
And what emerged was the Weimar Republic, which was all, you know, this kind of, at least when you look back historically, kind of a cool place in terms of the art and the architecture and even things like typefaces and stuff like that. All of this, like advertising, lots of really cool, creative stuff came out of Germany between the wars.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It was a total libertine place.
Yes.
Berlin in the 1920s. I mean, maybe you've seen Babylon Berlin, you know, I mean, it's, I know it was a big hit in the US as well.
Yeah.
You know, in Berlin, you could do everything there. Everything was allowed.
Yeah. Cabarets and all this kind of stuff. And then what happened was during at the end of the First World War, Germany famously had to pay reparations for the war. Yeah. They had to pay them in hard currency. They didn't have hard currency because Germany also thought that they were going to win World War. But this is a theme throughout history. We think they're going to win easily. So they basically borrowed all of the money to fight the war. Yeah. So not only did they owe reparations, they were also in debt. So the economy
was these war bonds.
Yeah, they were really, really in trouble. And what they did is they did what they made the mistake that governments make, which is they just printed more money.
Exactly.
And when you do that, people get wind of it very quickly and you have what's called hyperinflation, which is defined as the rate of inflation increasing 50% per month. Germany during the 1922-23 was, I think, the second worst historically of all time, second only to Hungary in the 40s, but it was really bad. The money became worthless. People used to drive it around in wheelbarrows. People would do things like they would buy pianos because they knew that they would retain value.
Yeah.
It was a complete chaos. And into that chaos stepped the Nazis. And they blame the Jews for the problems. They took some of the currency, which was Uniface, and they would print Nazi propaganda on the other side of it. So even after it was demonetized, they would use the actual currency as propaganda tools. And Hitler came to power. And then all of a sudden, this was wonderfully vibrant, creative place just completely inverted and went to hell. World War II happens. Obviously, we know about that. And then talk a little bit about what happened after the war, because that's the piece I think is interesting.
So Germany surrenders on May 8th, 1945. Of course, there were all these preparations by the US or by the Allies, you know, all these conferences that were already started in 1942, I believe, with the British, the Soviets, and the Americans. But of course, the Americans have been doing their own preparations. And initially you had, you know, Henry Morgenthau, the Treasury Secretary at the time, who made the infamous Morgenthau Plan, which basically called for the destruction of all of German industry and the summarily execution of, you know, basically all the top Nazis and the abolishment. I mean, he basically did not want Germany to be rebuilt. That plan was seriously considered, but did not end up going through. Instead, you had men from the state sector, from the State Department, who proposed these plans, such as, well, laid the groundwork for what eventually became the Nuremberg trials, in which the main one tried and sentenced 24 of Nazi Germany's top political and military leaders. Of course, three of the main ones were dead at that point, being Hitler, Josef Goebbels, and Heinrich Himmler. So the top dog there was Hermann Göring, and the rest of the country. Of course, Hermann Göring ends up committing suicide the day prior to him being executed. And there were talks of also having the German industrialists and businessmen of having a sort of kind of second main Nuremberg trial, as it were, but then only for German businessmen and CEOs and heirs and etc., who of course had fed the Nazi war machine tremendously and had gotten, you know, had gone even more wealthier or had remained as wealthy as they were prior to Hitler coming to power. That eventually doesn't happen because it would also be under Allied purview. Instead, you have the Americans, you have Telford Taylor, who was the American prosecutor put in charge of that. It goes to do these subsequent Nuremberg trials, as they're called, and they or oversees these, and it included three trials against German executive and industrialists, and them being against Friedrich Flick, who oversaw the Flick conglomerate, Krupp, and his executives. So Flick and five of his associates, Krupp and 10 of his executives, and basically the entire board of IG Farben, mm-hmm. which was the largest chemicals and pharmaceuticals company at the time. But on the other hand, of course, with the emergence of the Cold War, there is this political shift that happens where the Nazi crimes are very quickly forgotten, especially by the US.
Yep.
And there's more this idea that they need a strong West Germany as a bulwark against an encroaching Soviet Union. And what happens is that there are these very quick handovers of suspected Nazi war criminals by the US and the UK to Germany, which starts happening really in 1947. And in the so-called denazification trials, which today is very perverse because you hear Putin talking the whole time about the denazification right. of Ukraine. And denazification was a very specific term, a very flawed legal process that the Germans put in place of judging their own on sympathies and crimes that they had or crimes that they had committed. And these were mainly layman trials. You know, the judges, the prosecutors, the lawyers were not. Most Germans didn't really feel the need to judge their fellow compatriots on the crimes and sympathies that they had themselves. So these became perversities of justice.
Yeah.
And people were denazified, which allowed basically once West Germany was reestablished, was to have these power structures, both on government level and on business level, completely continue. So that is one aspect. Secondly, in 1950, John J. McCloy is appointed the High Commissioner for Occupied Germany, which at that point was already West Germany, but that was still the title he received. And the Korean War starts, and the Cold War is heating up. And this political decision is made is to basically commute the sentences of all these Waffen SS officers who murdered tens of thousands of Jews and other people in mainly in Eastern Europe, to commute their death sentences and turn them into life sentences. Those life sentences were then 3 years later commuted into freedom. And the industrialists like Flick and Krupp were also released on good behavior and were out by 1950. Or in Krupp's case, 1951, and he also received all his seized assets back. Mm-hmm. And that was that. You know, the U.S. had a strong new ally, West Germany. The Korean War, it was at that point, I think it started with Truman, but then, of course, quickly went into Eisenhower's purview. Truman made the decision to invoke the War Defense Act and block out all of the factories for weapons production. And West Germany was the industrialized nation that could fill the production vacuum. And what followed in the 1950s was the economic miracle of West Germany. And that's also at the time when the Flicks and the Quants return to power, come back to power and take over BMW and Daimler-Benz. And, West Germany becomes one of the wealthiest nations on the planet and all is forgotten.
Well, I want to mention the United States and the relationship that Americans have to Nazis, because
right.
I think now, 2022, it's very easy to say, okay, well, obviously Hitler is super evil, the Nazis are bad, everybody knows that. It's been sort of talked to death. We've been seen it right. in pop culture. Basically, anyone, I'm almost 50, so anybody my age and younger sure. has seen it all of our lives. But the reality is that even at the beginning of the war, or not the beginning of the war, the beginning of the rise of Hitler, mm-hmm. there were plenty of American Nazis. There was a lot of Nazis were popular in the United States. There was a huge oh, yeah. Nazi rally at Madison Square Garden in New York. You had, we already mentioned Henry Ford. You had Lindbergh was a sympathizer. the king of Britain who abdicated. Edward VIII was a Nazi sympathizer. His wife was a Nazi sympathizer. So yeah, this stuff, it wasn't as black and white as it now seems in hindsight. Like, there was a lot of sympathy. And at the end of the at the end of the war, of the Second World War, the United States feared that some of these German scientists and industrialists who knew all these secrets about stuff and knew how to make these weapons and all this stuff would wind up working for the Russians. They couldn't have that happen. So they did Operation Paperclip to bring these Nazis to the United States. And this all happened. You know, we did go get it after a period of a few months. The US just went right into bed with these guys.
Oh, yeah.
And as you mentioned, made West Germany into this huge, you know, this huge power. And now I feel, I've been to Berlin a bunch of times. Mm-hmm. Although I haven't traveled around, I'm not there. I'm only there like one weekend or whatever. So it's not, but my sense is that Germany as a country has tried, really made an effort to reconcile itself with its past in a way that the United States absolutely has not with regard to slavery or the, So that's what, that's another piece of your book that I found interesting. Like, but I think that the government and the people of Germany in general have given a lot of thought to,
I agree.
You know, reconciling their crimes, except for these 1% guys who seem not to be.
I fully agree with you. I think in many ways, I mean, the remembrance culture that is in Germany today, and that was started coming about in the 1970s, is incredible, and it's commendable. But the most powerful and wealthiest families, not just in not just of Germany, but in the world. I mean, we're talking about people who oversee tens of billions of fortune, tens of billion, and massive global brands, like, you know, not only like BMW and Porsche, but it's Volkswagen, it's Audi, it's Bentley, it's Lamborghini, it's Rolls-Royce. Name every car brand in the world, basically. And they use a very subtle but insidious way of rolling back history, of covering up history after the so-called reckoning process. I mean, they have billions on the line. They have billion-dollar brands on the line. They have their own billion-dollar fortunes on the line. And I also think, and I don't only see that in the case of German families, but in many families, the richer you get, the more removed from reality one gets, and the more one is surrounded by yes men and women who, you know, do not confront you with the reality, which is, do not name foundations after, do not name, you know, foundations after your father, who, after he's proven to be, to have committed crimes during the Third Reich. Yeah. And without then having the, at least having the decency of being transparent about these crimes.
Yeah. And I think that's the key. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
because that's, sorry, I just want to say one thing. Mm-hmm. That's how one learns from history, right? By showing the good and the bad, you know, by showing it's grayscales. It's not black and white. But you should say, you know, Herbert Quandt saved BMW from bankruptcy in 1960. He also oversaw, had the responsibility over a factory in Berlin with 500 female slave laborers from concentration camps who were kept there under the most horrific circumstances, or that he, you know, oversaw the planning, building, and dismantling of a sub-concentration camp in Nazi-occupied Poland, or that he acquired companies in France seized from Jews. Today, you have the Herbert Quandt BMW Foundation, whose motto is "Inspire responsible leadership," and yeah, you can't make this stuff up. And then the only sentence of his biography is, "He secured the independence of BMW in 1959." Yeah, so much for inspiring responsible leadership.
Yeah.
Inspiring responsible leadership is being transparent about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to talk more about all of that stuff, and I don't want to talk about it too at the end, because I think it's important to try to figure out, you know, what they should be doing. But we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with David DeYoung. Okay, we're back with David DeYoung. I want to delve into the guts of your book now a little bit, because there's a bunch of families that you really talk about. The main one seems to be the Quants, and some of these families I had not heard of before, but they're clearly their big names in Germany. And Germany is a huge, you know, as an industrial power and as a force on the world stage, is enormous. So just because, you know, an American like me living in New York hasn't heard of this guy doesn't mean they're not fantastically wealthy and control a lot of stuff that goes on in the world market. So,
well, and that American consumers consume every day.
Exactly. Exactly. So talk a little bit about, let's start with the Quants, because this is a family I didn't know about. Talk a little bit about them. And they're also, you know, tied in with Goebbels, which I think is...
Yes. Yeah. It's a complicated history. So Günther Quant was the dynasty patriarch. His first wife, Antonia, dies in the pandemic of 1918.
Yeah, Spanish flu.
It was called the Spanish flu. Exactly. And he has two sons with her, Herbert and Helmut. Helmut also ends up dying a few years later. But Günther then, on a train ride, meets a young woman called a 17-year-old. He's 37 at this point. Mm. A young woman called Magda Friedländer, who's in a boarding school in central Germany. And he starts courting her, and they very soon end up getting married. And they have one son called Harald. But that marriage falls apart also quite quickly. And Magda Friedländer then, in 1931, starts working for Joseph Goebbels, maintaining his private archive. And ends up becoming Magda Goebbels, the first lady of the Third Reich, who ends up also murdering her six children that she has with Joseph Goebbels in a Führer bunker 8 days before Germany surrenders. And then commit suicide. This is murder suicide with her husband in the garden of the Führer bunker. Yeah, which I don't know if you've ever seen a movie, The Downfall. It's often memed, the movie.
Yeah, I've seen the meme. I haven't seen
that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, the movie's great, but it's also immortalized in there. Günther Quant in the 1920s during the hyperinflation era takes over these two companies, a massive weapons company and a massive battery company. And then in 1933, once Hitler seizes power, is in this perfect position to, you know, start producing for the Nazi war machine. But he is at that point is in this massive custody battle with Joseph Goebbels, with Joseph and Magda Goebbels over the son he has with Magda, called with Harald, and he later uses that, and he gets arrested in just after becoming a member of the Nazi Party in 1933, and is detained for 6 weeks, and left out on and released on bail. But he uses that antagonistic relationship with Goebbels after the war as a reason to say, "Well, listen, I was a victim of the regime, and I was." Persecute. I mean, it's really, it's so brazen. I was persecuted to the full extent. And he writes this completely whitewashed autobiography while in detention after the war. While in fact, he used almost 60,000 people in forced and slave labor across Germany in the most awful of circumstances. He builds a sub-concentration. He has a sub-concentration camp built with the SS close to one of his battery factories, which has become notorious for the amount of the people that were murdered there and that died under the most atrocious of circumstances. He's a mass producer of weapons. He's one of the largest weapons producers of the Third Reich. And he seizes across, not only in Germany, but across Nazi-occupied Europe, countless of companies, not only owned by Jews, but also owned by people who happen to live in Nazi-occupied territories. In Greece, Serbia, Poland, Belgium, France, you know, and many of his efforts even fail. If he had succeeded in all of them, it would have been many, many more companies that he would have coercively taken over.
So he basically was an opportunist who totally used his station within the Third Reich to basically steal other companies, because they were for sale. They were only available because of the war, because of
exactly. Or prior to the war, because of the Nazi regime forcing Jewish business owners to sell their livelihood.
You know,
he took people's livelihood as as did his son, who helped the now the exalted Herbert Quandt BMW Foundation, who helped, you know, Herbert helped his father or for his father acquired companies seized from Jews in France.
Okay. Yeah. And he was the one that Herbert was the one that that saved BMW, right? Or no?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Okay. Yes, exactly. Yeah. It's all very confusing because they're all of their names start with an H, yeah. Which Magda Goebbels also ends up doing, ends up all calling her six children also with an H. It's
some people are into that.
One can only speculate which H that would have been, but after who they were named, but you know.
Yeah, right. Got it. Yeah. The Roman Emperor, you know, Constantine the Great, his father, he had, you know, Constantine, Constantius, Constans, and Constantine Jr. And then also the daughter was named Constantia. So it's not, this does happen. It's just weird though.
Gotcha.
I feel like maybe if we diversify the names a little. So, okay. The next family is the Flicks.
Right.
And what do they do? That's Benz. That's Daimler-Benz.
Well, they did. They owned Daimler-Benz. They started selling it off in 1975, and they sold off the rest of their entire family conglomerate in 1985. So they only today, you have two branches, the multimillionaire branch and the multi-billion branch. And the multi-billion branch actually did quite a good job of reckoning with their past. It's only the billionaire branch who is now still maintaining a foundation in the name of a Nazi war criminal convicted at Nuremberg. Not only that, it sits on the board, on the foundation board of one of Germany's most prestigious universities. I mean, it's wild. But Friedrich Flick, as I explained earlier, owned the largest, was probably the most iconic German industrialist of the 20th century, and was already Germany's wealthiest man, if not the wealthiest, by 1930, because he owned the largest, or he got into control of the largest steel conglomerate in Europe, only bested by US Steel at the time in terms of size, and builds up his own namesake conglomerate during the Third Reich, which becomes one of the largest, if not the largest, privately held steel, coal, and weapons conglomerate in the Nazi era. Is apprehended by the Americans in 1945, is tried at Nuremberg, gets convicted for 7 to 7 years, and is then commuted, his sentence is then commuted by John J. McCloy in 1950, and he's released. He still has all his money left. I mean, a lot of his, you know, half of his empire has been expropriated in the Soviet Union, in the Soviet occupied zone at that point, East Germany, but he still has plenty of assets left in the West.
Yeah.
And starts selling off parts of his in parts of his conglomerate and reinvesting that into Daimler-Benz, and then ends up being the controlling shareholder of Daimler-Benz, and again Germany's wealthiest man by 1960. And was, you know, at the time of his death in 1972, was one of the top five world's wealthiest men. It was only, I think, Joe Getty. Mm-hmm. What was Getty's name?
John Paul Getty.
Pardon. Yeah. Who was wealthier than him. So a very infamous figure.
Yeah.
To say the least. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, and then you have the Von Finks, which, you know.
Yes, fascinating.
If we were to make up a name of an evil German family, yes. That we could not do worse than that.
Yes, that is very true. Yeah, so the Von Finks were a financier's family, or now an investing family, who were the patriarch co-founded Allianz and Munich Re, which are two of the largest insurers and reinsurer companies in the world today. And they also controlled this private bank called Merck Fink, which I also sold 30 years ago. Now, the patriarch dies, and then his son, August von Fink Sr., inherits all his board positions at Allianz and Munich Re, inherits private bank. And Hitler asks him in 1933 if he wants to, because he's very stingy. He's known as Bavaria's, they're based in Munich. He's known as Bavaria's wealthiest and stingiest man. And he is then asked by Hitler if he can fundraise for, Hitler has this pet project, the Museum of German Art.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That he runs, which is a which is today is an iconic building in Munich, right on the southern border of the English Garden. And he then fundraises with all his fellow industrialists and tycoons, and about 20 million Reichsmark in the end. There is this massive, you know, opening of the museum in 1937. And as a thank you, the Nazi regime allows him to Aryanize, as the, which was a catch-all term for the seizing or the buying of Jewish-owned assets. He's then allowed to Aryanize the Rothschild Bank in Vienna, which was owned by the Austrian branch of the Rothschilds, which was never reconstituted after the war, because they fled to the US. And the Dreyfus Bank in Berlin, and von Finck, was, like Günter Quandt, was also denazified under very, you know, in laughable proceedings, and both returned back to work in 1950. Yeah, and although there's one hilarious episode where August von Finck is pissed off because of his Nazi connections that he's not allowed to return as a supervisory board chairman at Allianz and Munich Re, two of the most prominent positions in finance at that point already today as well. And then stages a hostile takeover of both company in the 1950s as a revenge move, which completely ends up failing, but it just goes to show just, the audacity, the sheer audacity of, of a lack of reflection.
Well, also, they don't think, he doesn't think the rules apply to him, which is something that translates across the board. I mean, we see this, in the US with the Trumps and all the rules just don't apply, you know, to different rules for the rich people and everybody else. Do any of these families have, you mentioned Deutsche Bank before, do any of these families have connections to Deutsche Bank or no?
Günter Quandt served on the supervisory board of Deutsche Bank. I mean, there's this very famous banker, Hermann Josef Abs, who was called the linchpin of plunder in the third, in the Nazi era. Comes West Germany's most influential financier as chairman of Deutsche Bank. And actually, I don't know if you ever read David Enrich's book, Dark Towers, but it reversed, it goes into absolute as well a little bit. And he becomes chairman of Daimler Benz. He works together very closely with the Quants and the Flicks. I mean, he's basically, he's everywhere in West German industry. So Deutsche Bank during the war, of course, played a horrific role, financing concentration and extermination camps and financing the takeover mass financing weapons production, but becomes really ubiquitous after in West Germany and becomes this most powerful institution between 1950 and 1999, prior to reunification, and very much under Abs's purview, who works very closely together with the Quants and the Flicks, and probably also other families in my book.
Okay. I mean, even in Casablanca, the movie, which was released in 1941, they make fun of Deutsche Bank. I mean, he won't let the Deutsche Bank guy into the back room.
Never do that.
The guy says, "You know who I am?" And he says, "Yes, I do. You're lucky the bar is open to you." That's it. That's just a little taste. The book is really good. It's well written, well researched, and there's a lot of interesting stuff in there. I want to talk about a couple of things. Like, I'm thinking about the people that are involved here now, going through the war, going through this. If I'm the next generation or the third generation removed, what do you do? Like, how do you reconcile that? Like, what is the thing to do? Like, you said at the end of the book, you talk about going to a museum in Israel, Tel Aviv, and seeing the names of some of these people written who gave money to the museum, which on the one hand, you could say, well, at least they gave money to the museum. But on the other hand, they're not disclosing why or who they are. So how would you like this to, what do you think these families should do now? If I'm, you mentioned these guys who are in their 30s, the billionaires from the Flick family. What should they do, in your opinion?
Well, my argument is actually that the current generation, one that were born from, after the war, as late as, say between 1945 and 1970 or 1980, but not the fourth generation, the current generation needs to deal with this. So the next generation does not, because they have nothing to do with that. Yeah. It really is reckoning with the sins of the father or the grandfather, but really then it stops, you know. People shouldn't feel, you know, it the buck ends somewhere, even though if it doesn't literally end,
yeah,
it continues. So, no, it's the current generation now in their 50s and 60s or 70s and 80s, which should reckon with it in a transparent way and not by commissioning studies in academic German and then saying, well, it's on the bookshelf and saying it's all here, we reckoned with it, and then going on globally, because their business interests are global, to, you know, maintain even journalism prizes. I mean, there's the Herbert Quan Journalism Prize, you know, one of the largest journalism prizes, global foundations, corporate headquarters in the name of these men, without explaining anywhere, either online or at a placard, what these men did, you know, both the good and the bad.
Yeah.
Because then it just indicates, you know, so business success is more important than morality. That's what it basically signifies. You know, yeah. Oh yeah, they were successful in business. This excuses everything else, apparently. That's what BMW and Porsche are doing today.
Yeah. I mean, they're relying on, certainly they have stuff that they wouldn't necessarily have had they not had the original group that existed during the war, that lived during the war, you know, refused to do it or just left or didn't accept the labor situation. There's lots of things that they probably could have done. There's probably some things they couldn't do. You know, it wasn't like a free society or whatever, but I'm sure there are many things that they could have done differently, but they certainly seem to have fallen all in with Hitler without losing too much sleep over it, as it seems to be the case.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, Günter Quandt in his white boy, you know, in his ingratiating biography that he writes while in detention in 1946, 1947, he writes that he could have left. He could have left Nazi Germany whenever he wanted to, you know, could have gone to North or South America. But he stayed, you know, he stayed behind like a loyal soldier, you know, caring for his companies and his employees.
Yeah.
So this whole thing where they said, well, which his grandson later said in an infamous speech about, my father and grandfather were also forced to, he said something along the lines of, they also had to make their way in this, you know, under this horrible regime. Whereas his grandfather clearly stated, I could have left, I stayed.
Yeah, I mean, everybody.
There is an example of one of Hitler's earliest backers, Fritz Thyssen of the famous ThyssenKrupp steel conglomerate, who is one of Hitler's earliest backers and then ends up turning against him as a member of parliament in 1939 at the eve of the outbreak of the German invasion of Poland, and ends up, you know, fleeing to Paris, writing with an American journalist a total whitewash of a biography called I Paid Hitler, and then ends up in a concentration camp.
Yeah.
So you know, there are counterexamples of similar industrialists of a very prominent industrialist who did that.
Yeah.
And of course, as a consequence, his steel conglomerate was occupied by the Nazi regime and was put under trustee of actually Friedrich Flick's right hand man, of course, because the spoils were divided among their own.
Yeah. So that was the case. They either had to stay and you know, pillage basically, and be pillagers under the delusion that they were doing it for country and their employees, which is ridiculous because the people working for them were slave laborers. So I don't know what employees they're talking about. Or they could, you know, they could do something else. Certainly people in that position did have the ability to leave if they wanted. I mean, again, it's easy for me to look back in time and say, well, you should have done this, this, and this, but clearly there were lines. They had plenty of off-ramps, and Hitler was especially if you're involved in any way with the concentration camps, you can't pretend not to know what was going on. I mean,
exactly.
Yeah, it's just
especially in the case of Herbert Quandt, where you oversee the building of a sub-concentration camp yourself, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It can't not be that way. So did you meet any of these people now, the people from the families? Are they like, oh God, this is junk, leave me alone, you know, or What has the reception been like for you?
Well, I mean, first of all communication, well, not all, but most of the communication goes through their spokespeople, either for their family offices or for their companies that they still control.
Yeah.
So they, I had one air comment on record or correspond with on record, and his comments, part of his comments are at the end of the book. But all my other interview requests were declined.
Yeah.
And some companies answered questions, some said no comment, others didn't respond, you know. It's,
but there was the thing,
statements.
Like, you're out at a bar in Berlin and somebody comes up and is like, you're the guy that wrote the thing about my family, nothing like that.
Well, actually, you'd be surprised how close Germany's dark history is in Berlin. There have been some pretty surreal encounters in Berlin. Which included mainly heirs of political families, but not of the industrial, not of the people who still have the money.
So, okay, delving away a bit from this. Now, you were in Germany for a while. You obviously have studied what's going on there. What do you think is happening now with the new leader of Germany vis-a-vis Russia? And what's your read on what's going on there?
It's a very messy there. I mean, they announced, or Olaf Scholz, Angela Merkel's chancellor, announced a week after the invasion of Ukraine, of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, that they were going to do, that they were introducing a 100 billion defense budget, which is, you know, from a country that is so worried about ever getting involved into a conflict again, was a total deal breaker. It was a total game changer. Since then, Germany has been pretty much useless. The problem with Germany is that they've made themselves completely reliant on Russia for gas. The Nord Stream 2 example, which has been much discussed, which they've also shut down, which hasn't become operationally active yet, but it's finally discontinued. There was already a lot of protests against it before Russia invaded Ukraine. But still, I mean, I think 60 or 80% of German gas comes from Russia. And there's a lot of, you know, both on the left and right side of the aisle, there are a lot of Russia. There is a lot of, in Germany, there's a lot of Russia supporters, you know. A lot of goodness, yeah.
We have them in the United States too.
Yes, you do. But frankly, there are, well, bar one, they're less relevant, you know? Because of course, you know, for Europe, but also for the rest of the world, I mean, it is always important to say Germany after the US and China is the third largest economy in the world, you know? We're talking about one of the biggest players in the world here. So it is the policy decisions they make have implications for Europe first and foremost, but they also have reverberations in the US.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, that's why I'm concerned with it. And
Similarly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they've basically have themselves held hostage in a way to Russia. Yeah, so it's going to be very interesting how they're going to climb themselves out of that hole. If anything, usually what is very German is they try to ignore it until it becomes too late to ignore it, I mean, there's a precedent there.
Yes, there is. Yeah. Okay, so the book is called Nazi Billionaires, The Dark History of Germany's Wealthiest Dynasties. David DeYoung, thank you. Oh, where can we find you? You're on Twitter, yes?
Yes, I'm on Twitter at David the THEJONG and on Instagram.
Okay. What's your Instagram like? Where do you take pictures of?
I take pictures of finished cartons of my book arriving at my apartment and saying, wow, after 4 years, my baby is finally here.
I, as a fellow person who generates books occasionally, I feel the love. I feel the pride in that. And, you know, it's a great
Thank
book.
You. Yeah, it's my first book. So you know, I'm just super pumped for it to come out. Yeah.
And, it's terrific.
Thank you.
I hope everybody goes and buys it and reads. It's you know, it's really well done. David DeYoung, thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Greg. great being here.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fassa. Sophia Tereshenko provided the Russian introduction. Voice talent is provided by Tally Briggs, Signet Della, Stephanie St. John, Brett Petticord, Ryan Byrne at History Falls Apart, and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kenai Williams, and everyone else at MSW Media. Please subscribe to the Prevail website with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $5 monthly subscription funds the site and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Don't forget to tip your server. Until next time, we shall prevail. MSW.